Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the city of Gary owing $3 million in overdue bills to Cigna. LaPorte native Dr. Tamara O'Neill is remembered by loved ones at her Celebration of Life service. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Updates. Loved ones came together Friday morning to remember the doctor from LaPorte who was killed in the Mercy Hospital shooting in Chicago November 19th. Dr. Tamara O'Neill, 38, was known by her family as the life of the party and by fellow church members as a vivacious choir director. At 11 a.m. Friday at First Church of God in LaPorte, O'Neill's life of service to others was celebrated. After services, O'Neill was laid to rest at the Pine Lake Cemetery. Memorial contributions can be made to the Christian Fellowship Worship Center at 2468 North State Road 39, LaPorte, Indiana. O'Neill's brother, LaShawn O'Neill, is the pastor at Christian Fellowship Worship Center, where the doctor was an active member. Feminine, an organization for women working in emergency medicine, is remembering O'Neill's life and death by funding research they hope will help prevent future tragedies. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. City administrators this week are switching employees to a new healthcare insurance company as they pay down $4.6 million in overdue payments to their former insurance company, Cigna. Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson said the city paid Cigna $1.6 million in overdue payments this week and will pay the remaining $3 million balance to Cigna by the end of the year. The Times reports the city is switching from Cigna to AIM Medical Trust, resulting in nearly $800,000 in savings. The switch to a new healthcare company is part of the administration's financial recovery plan aimed at tackling the city's $17 million budget deficit. The mayor has said the plan is critical to addressing the longstanding debt in the city and getting Gary on stable financial footing. Through a combination of aggressive permit and licensee fee collections, department consolidation, revenue generators, and economic developments, Freeman Wilson has said she hopes city government can match spending levels with revenue in due time.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Spectacle Entertainment announced Wednesday it will merge with Majestic Holdco LLC in a cash transaction. Previously, Majestic Holdco sold Majestic Mississippi LLC, the owner and operator of a casino and hotel in Tunica, Mississippi, to Foundation Gaming Group in August 2018. Majestic Holdco owns the subsidiaries, the Majestic Star Casino LLC and the Majestic Star Casino 2 LLC, both of which are included in the sale. The two subsidiaries own and operate adjacent dockside casino vessels at Buffington Harbor in Gary, Indiana. The Post Tribune reports Spectacle Entertainment Chairman and CEO Rob Ratcliffe said, quote, Spectacle's acquisition of the two gaming licenses located in Gary presents a tremendous economic opportunity for the city of Gary as well as the state of Indiana. We welcome the prospect of working with Gary and the General Assembly to maximize the value of these two licenses by allowing Buffington Harbor to become part of an intermodal hub, creating additional employment and increasing state and local tax revenue. The transaction is subject to receipt of regulatory approval and is expected to close in the first quarter of 2019.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Authorities say police in Hammond shot a teen after a chase involving a stolen vehicle. Indiana police say the 15-year-old male suspect suffered a non-life-threatening injury in the shooting Tuesday morning. They did not say where on his body the teen was wounded. Police say the teen is black, as are two of three Hammond police officers involved in the shooting. The other officer is Hispanic. The officers' names weren't immediately released. Police say no other details were being released.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Environmental Protection Agency is making progress on a long-awaited groundwater investigation at the USS Lead Superfund site in East Chicago. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the EPA will oversee the installation of 10 more groundwater monitoring wells at the site.
The EPA says it's possible that the USS Lead site is contaminating the groundwater with arsenic and lead. But attorney Debbie Chisower, who represents residents through the Northwestern University Law School's Environmental Advocacy Clinic, says she already knows it's polluted. In the early 2000s, the EPA found that an adjacent hazardous waste site was contaminating the groundwater.
This area has been studied time and time again, and not enough action has been taken.
Chisower says contaminated groundwater often floods people's homes or gets pumped out onto their lawns. Though the groundwater doesn't supply drinking water to residents of the site, the EPA may make it safe to drink for future use. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Franciscan Express Care is now open to provide a convenient alternative to the emergency room at its new location at 101 West 61st Avenue in Hobart. Franciscan Express Care allows patients with non-life-threatening cases to be seen and diagnosed by a healthcare provider with no need for an appointment. Whether it's a rash, sore throat, or a tumble off the back deck, their physicians will treat minor injuries and illnesses and will refer patients back to their doctor if follow-up care is needed. The 61st Street location, just west of Lake Park Avenue, also features Franciscan Working Well Occupational Health Services, providing businesses a range of healthcare services from wellness and education to rehabilitation. Franciscan Express Care is open 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. For more information, go to franciscanexpresscare.org or call 219-945-9530.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana authorities say a 32-year-old man with gunshot wounds died in an emergency room after he was found lying on the ground outside the Geary Hospital. Police said in a release Sunday that staff from Methodist Hospital Northlake reported the man's body was discovered by firefighters Saturday night. He had been dropped off near the emergency room doors by an unknown vehicle that fled. The man, who had been shot in the back, was being treated when he died.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb announced Thursday he won't move forward with a plan to toll Indiana's interstate highways. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that decision comes as part of a study mandated by the legislature.
The comprehensive 2017 road funding bill required a study of tolling. The results suggest tolls on major highways could help ensure long-term sustainable road funding, especially as current revenues from gas taxes begin to decline. But the study also says such a system would be complicated and take a long time to set up, at least 4 years to collect the first toll, and decades to fully flesh out a statewide system. Governor Holcomb says Indiana's current road needs are adequately funded by that 2017 bill, and he says while he won't pursue tolling, he had the Department of Transportation create a strategic plan for future leaders to consider. That plan focuses on open road tolling, meaning no toll booths, and it centers on I-65, I-70, and I-94. The plan estimates tolls could eventually generate around $1 billion a year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
House Speaker Brian Bosma says he'll cooperate fully with any ethics investigation into allegations about his use of campaign funds to allegedly intimidate a former intern who says they had a sexual encounter 2 decades ago. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that even as an investigation looks uncertain.
A former House Democratic intern says she had a sexual encounter with Brian Bosma more than 20 years ago, and she claims an attorney hired by Bosma this year harassed her friends and family in an effort to intimidate and discredit her. House Democrats want an ethics investigation into Bosma's use of campaign dollars for that attorney. Bosma says he'll participate in any inquiry from the Ethics Committee.
Going to cooperate in every way. They have some information in front of them. If they request more, they'll receive more, and we'll just see how it goes.
Greg Steuerwald has been the Ethics Committee chair. He sidesteps any questions about a Bosma investigation.
I don't even know who's on the committee this year.
4 of last session's 6 committee members left the General Assembly. New members haven't been named. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Speaker Brian Bosma announced leadership assignments Thursday for House committees in the 2019 legislative session. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on some of the notable changes.
The announcement includes the lawmaker who will help write the state budget for House Republicans. Todd Houston will co-chair the Ways and Means Committee, assisting longtime Rep. Tim Brown, who is still recovering from a serious motorcycle accident. Wendy McNamara will now chair the Courts and Criminal Code Committee, while Jerry Torr will lead House Judiciary. Neither are lawyers, unlike the previous chairs. Sharon Nagel is the new head of the Ethics Committee. That panel could investigate Speaker Brian Bosma in the coming session. That's after Bosma used campaign dollars to hire an attorney who allegedly intimidated a former intern who says she had an affair with the GOP leader. And Ed Soliday will no longer lead the Roads Committee, replaced there by Holly Sullivan. Senate Republicans last session blamed Soliday for derailing an autonomous vehicles bill. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A report authored by several federal agencies says few Midwestern cities have plans for how they'll adapt to climate change. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, it shows that they're already seeing some of the harmful effects.
Whether it's stronger hurricanes like Harvey or more intense, long-lasting wildfires like the Camp Fire in California, the report says climate change is having an impact on extreme weather events across the country. Jeff Dukes is the director of the Purdue Climate Change Research Center.
But of course, here in Indiana, we're not expecting to see massive wildfires raging across the land in that way. What we expect to see here is more extremely hot days.
That could mean more heat-related deaths, reduced crop yields, and fewer tourists. Duke says Indiana will also likely experience more large rains, leading to extreme flooding. The Midwest can expect to pay more for damages to infrastructure as a result of the weather changes than some other regions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Solar advocates say it's not too late to take advantage of higher rates for net metering in Indiana. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the state moved to phase down credits for solar customers who deliver excess energy to the grid. But those higher retail rates haven't expired yet.
When the state passed a law to significantly lower net metering rates last year, Hoosiers were in a hurry to buy solar panels. But since then, John Vann says people don't seem as interested. Vann is a retired Ball State University professor and co-leads the group Solarize East Central Indiana, which helps people to buy affordable solar panels. He says some of his first presentations had more than 40 attendees, but now few people show up.
We gave another one in Muncie just about a week ago, and only one couple came. I knew the husband of the couple and had just invited him to come when I saw him at the YMCA.
Vann says not many people know higher net metering rates are still available. Hoosiers who install solar panels before July 1, 2022 can get at least 10 years of net metering at the retail rate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
For the first time in DePaul University history, faculty members approved a vote of no confidence in the university's chief executive. Faculty voted last week to approve the resolution concerning university president Mark McCoy. They cite concerns about financial stability, cutbacks to employee health care, and how recent hate crimes on campus were handled, among other things. Howard Brooks is a professor and chair of the faculty. He says the vote has no power, but they wanted to send the Board of Trustees a message.
The faculty pulled this card out in terms of vote of no confidence to make sure the board understood how upset the faculty were. I mean, we've never done a vote of no confidence in the president before.
About 31% of faculty members voted to approve the measure, while 21% opposed it. 24% voted to abstain, and the rest didn't participate in the vote. In a letter sent to faculty after the vote, the trustees say they remain confident in McCoy's ability to lead the institution, and they say the vote of no confidence is unwarranted. The board suggests having a forum between faculty, administration, and trustees to discuss concerns. Special advisor to the president, Ken Owen, declined an interview but said in a statement, the president is carrying out necessary changes that the Board of Trustees has asked him to make, like cutting costs and investing more in the student experience.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Starting this year, Indiana requires more school staff and all teachers to train in suicide prevention and awareness. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on one opportunity presented in Indianapolis this week.
The annual Kids Count Conference, hosted by the Indiana Youth Institute, or IYI, gathers people who work with youth from around the state. This year, high school staff and teachers had the opportunity to receive the now mandatory certification in suicide prevention and awareness. They learned a technique called the Question, Persuade, Refer, or QPR. Director of the Indiana Suicide Prevention Coalition, Alice Jordan Miles, says QPR is to the mental body what CPR is to the physical body.
Just like CPR, the first time they do it, it's really scary. You know, how can I save someone's life? If I wanted to save someone's life, I would have been a doctor.
The three-step training teaches people how to ask the right questions, persuade them to get help, and where to refer them. According to the IYI, 1 in 5 high school students in Indiana seriously contemplate suicide, one of the highest rates in the country. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A South Bend abortion clinic is still barred from opening after a State Department of Health panel reversed an administrative judge's earlier ruling. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the results of Wednesday's hearing in Indianapolis.
Whole Woman's Health Alliance applied for a license for an abortion clinic more than a year ago. The state denied that application. It said the alliance didn't provide necessary information about its other clinics around the country. But the alliance argued before an administrative judge in August those other clinics aren't affiliated with the alliance, and the judge agreed, overturning the state's denial. A 3-person appeals panel at the Department of Health reversed that decision in a 2-to-1 vote. An explanation for that ruling will come in the near future in an official order from the panel. The alliance's Sharon Lau says the panel's ruling is part of an overall attack by the state on women's health care.
We're not going to give up, and we will be pursuing all of our legal options to continue moving forward to provide that health care.
The next step would be an appeal within 30 days for judicial review in a Marion County court. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The beginning of a child's life is a time for bonding with mom. But what happens if mom is in prison? Side Effects Public Media's Paige Flager reports on an unusual program in Ohio that's getting a new home.
Alicia Floyd bounces her son Chance on her lap.
He's the fattest baby here.
He's 4 months old, and his chunky little legs stick out of his blue striped onesie. The room's cinder block walls are covered in paintings of Sesame Street characters. Baby dolls lie tucked into miniature beds on the windowsill. Outside, surrounding the Ohio Reformatory for Women, there's a tall chain-link fence topped with barbed wire.
I was actually a month before my due date when I got sentenced.
Floyd is part of the prison's Achieving Baby Care Success Program, or ABC. It lets women who are pregnant when they're incarcerated keep their babies with them.
This is my first child, so if I didn't have him, I'd probably melt down. I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to raise him. So, I mean, it's a blessing, honestly, to be here. It's a big blessing.
There are a lot of women like Floyd. Some estimate that 1 in 25 women entering prison or jail is pregnant. But ABC is the only program of its kind in Ohio and one of about 10 in the country. In the Midwest, Indiana and Illinois have similar programs. The reformatory's warden, Ronette Burks, says the nursery program is good for the babies and a learning experience for the moms.
You go to school and you learn how to do all these things, but who teaches you how to be a parent?
The idea is to give mothers a chance to do things like breastfeed and bond with their newborns. That improves a child's long-term health and well-being. Studies show that children who spent time with their mothers in a prison nursery had less anxiety and depression than children who were separated because of incarceration. At the reformatory, a large window lets officers outside keep watch over the ABC nursery. But Floyd says it also allows some inmates to look in.
That's where the people look in the window and stare at the babies and stuff like that. We don't know what their charges are. So that's really what I don't like. That's the only part I don't like.
Ora Yazel just joined the unit, which can handle about 24 moms. She points out the walls of the rooms where moms and babies sleep don't go all the way to the ceiling. She says it's hard enough to get her newborn son, Jacob, to sleep without the sounds of other babies crying, too.
I just got my baby to go back to sleep. Please, please stop crying. Please don't wake him up with your crying.
A new nursery building under construction should address those concerns. It also will have a full kitchen and more space for ABC programming. That includes breastfeeding consultation, postpartum counseling, Head Start, and weekly appointments with a pediatrician. It will cost the state more than $2 million. Warden Burke says the program helps moms develop good habits and skills that they take with them. Women in ABC also have to get a job or take classes.
We have a mom over there in college, and so how wonderful is it that she has an opportunity to work on her college degree, raise her child in a healthy environment?
She sometimes hears from people who think these nurseries are rewarding bad behavior. Other critics have argued that women in trouble with the law are unfit for motherhood. Prison officials point out that not every mother can join the ABC program. Offenders can't have a violent crime conviction or a history of problems with child services. Moms in the program typically were convicted of theft, parole violations, or similar crimes.
We certainly can't control the fact that they come to prison, but we can definitely control what we do with them while they're here and do our part as public servants to ensure or to at least give people all the tools they need so they don't come back.
Prison leaders say of the more than 300 women who have been through the ABC program, about 50 have returned to prison. That's slightly lower than the overall recidivism rate for women inmates in Ohio. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Paige Flager.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
About 2 weeks ago, the South Bend Tribune published a series of investigative reports about issues within the justice system in Elkhart County. Side Effects Public Media's Jennifer Weingart sat down with Tribune reporter Christian Scheckler, who, along with reporters from ProPublica, dug into the Elkhart Police Department.
The investigative report that you're doing focuses on the Elkhart Police Department. How did you get into that story?
Well, we pitched the idea of looking into criminal justice issues in Elkhart County to ProPublica because of a very historic thing that had happened, which was the pardon of Keith Cooper in early 2017. He received Indiana's first ever pardon based on innocence. Most pardons are for someone who admits that they have done a crime and have sort of since turned their life around or have a good reason why they should be pardoned and have the criminal record wiped off their record. But in this case, the governor actually gave Cooper a pardon based on innocence, essentially finding that he did not commit the crime that he had been convicted of years earlier. And that was an interesting case that we thought raised interesting questions about criminal justice in Elkhart County and involved a lot of individuals at different steps along the way in that case that have still been in influential positions, whether in Elkhart County or at the state level, or have actually risen to higher positions since then, such as the chief of police or the state attorney general or the Elkhart County prosecutor. And so we thought it would be worthwhile to spend some time looking and seeing if there were more issues worth exploring in the justice system in Elkhart County.
Looking at the key findings, you did, one of the reports was on the Keith Cooper case, but then you started digging into disciplinary issues and personnel files, and you found a lot of the supervisors in the department had pretty lengthy disciplinary records. Can you just tell me a little bit about what you found in those records?
Well, what we found in the records that we examined, which included the 34 highest-ranking officers on the Elkhart Police Department, from sergeant up to chief of police, is that of those 34 highest ranking officers, 28 of them had been disciplined at least once during their career. 15 had been suspended. 7 of the highest ranking 34 officers on the department have been involved in fatal shootings during their career. 3 have actually been convicted of criminal offenses. We found that the current assistant chief of police, who was appointed by the current chief less than 3 years before he was promoted to assistant chief, had actually been a lieutenant but was demoted 2 ranks because he made comments about a fatal shooting that another police officer was involved in, where he said now this officer could check shooting a person off of his bucket list, according to witnesses who reported this. We found that one of the captains that was promoted to that role by the current police chief had previously been suspended 4 days for sending inappropriate emails that included some really gruesome images of a man who was killed during a police chase in another city. And we found that there was one sergeant who was promoted to that position by the current chief who had actually been disciplined at least 27 times before he was promoted. I believe he was suspended 11 times and reprimanded 15 times before he was promoted to sergeant. So we did find multiple instances where officers had somewhat substantial disciplinary records before being promoted to a command role in the department.
And one of the things you also found is after the current chief was appointed as chief, discipline in the department went down a lot. And then one of the things that you pulled out is the beating of Mario Guerrero Ledesma. Can you tell me a little bit about what you found with that? There was a video involved. What happened?
One thing we noticed is that disciplinary actions that are being brought by the current police chief to the city's civilian oversight board that is ultimately in charge of hiring and promotion and discipline of officers have really declined since he became chief in 2016. We were interested in looking at a couple of the cases that he has brought forward. And one of them was a case involving 2 officers that was described as a violation of the department's policies on use of force. And these 2 officers received written reprimands. So we were interested in seeing what that was about and ultimately learned, while the chief described this incident to the Merit Commission as these 2 officers having gone a little overboard with a subject who was in custody, actually what the officers had done was punched this person in the face while the person was in handcuffs. So that seemed like worth looking into more. And so we asked for the video of this incident. What had happened was this person, who was wearing handcuffs at the time, spit at one of the officers. And the 2 officers, while the man was handcuffed and sitting in a chair, pushed him backwards onto the floor and then punched him about 10 times between the 2 of them. We published the video of what had happened. Since then, the mayor of Elkhart has acknowledged that perhaps these 2 officers could have been disciplined a little more severely than just the reprimands that they received from the police chief at the time.
Since then, the mayor has requested that the Indiana State Police look into this. They have declined. The Indiana State Police told the mayor that there would be a Department of Justice issue. This is something the Department of Justice under President Trump have not really been doing. Should it be the Department of Justice? Is there anyone else that looks into these things? Have you heard of any reaction of anyone looking more into this because of your report and just going forward?
The mayor of Elkhart has, you know, said that he's taking this seriously, what had happened with the incident where the handcuffed man was punched in January, and that he's looking into it and trying to get answers. He did ask that the Indiana State Police not only take part in the criminal case that's been filed against the 2 officers as a result of what had happened. Both officers who punched this man were charged with misdemeanor battery. And he asked that the state police work hand in hand with the Elkhart County Prosecutor's Office in that criminal case. But he also asked that the state police basically come in and do a broader look at whether there are patterns of excessive force in the police department. And the state police responded that they felt, since charges have already been filed, that there wouldn't really be a reason for them to come in and do a criminal investigation now that the Elkhart County prosecutors have already filed charges. And in addition to that, it's not really the state police's role, as they see it, to investigate operations of other police departments, to look at these types of patterns that the Elkhart mayor has asked them to look at. And so they did say, typically something like allegations of civil rights violations would be something that would be investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice. Under the current administration, the Trump administration, the Department of Justice has backed off a previous role that they had where they would go into local police departments and investigate possible civil rights violations. So it's unclear whether the Department of Justice would actually do an investigation like that, even if the mayor of Elkhart asked them to. So it's a situation where it's not really clear whether there's anybody at the state or federal level who can do an investigation like that. I will say that in 1994, the mayor of Elkhart at the time actually had some private consultants who were former, one of them was a former New York City police commissioner. He had them come in and do a review of the police department. And so there is precedent in the past for the city of Elkhart, you know, asking not a government agency, but a private consulting firm to come in and do a similar type of investigation.
I've been speaking with Christian Scheckler of the South Bend Tribune. Links to his reporting on the Elkhart Police Department can be found on our website. You can also look up the stories at southbendtribune.com or at propublica.org. Thanks, Christian, for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer. I really
appreciate it. Elkhart Police Chief Ed Winbigler is now serving a 30-days unpaid suspension over the problems uncovered by Scheckler's reporting. Since this interview was recorded, Elkhart Mayor Tim Neese has announced he has asked the U.S. Department of Justice to look into the Elkhart Police Department.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Richly Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson.
Tell people, if you will, for those who are not familiar, within the surveyor's office, you get to keep track of all of the ditches in Lake County, and they're all over the county, come to think of it, especially if they're located outside the cities and towns.
Sure, absolutely. So, as a surveyor, as a Lake County surveyor, I'm the technical advisor for the Lake County Drainage Board, which are the three commissioners, the three county commissioners, and we have over 600 miles of what are called county regulated drains. So those are open ditches, tiled farm tiles, old sewer pipes, and things like that that we maintain. And there are a lot of them in municipalities and also in the unincorporated areas as well.
We know that most people see the ditches around, especially if you live or travel through North Lake County a lot, and even as far south, I guess, in sections of North Lake County is the town of Griffith and other places in Highland. The ditches are there. You see a lot of times what condition they're in as well, too. How long does it take, on average, to get on the big list to make sure that somebody knows at the surveyor's office that a particular ditch or ditches need to be maintained?
Well, that's a good question. So it kind of depends on the waterway itself. So we have to consider a lot of things. And one of them being, for example, on Katie Marsh Ditch, it runs through Highland, Griffith, and then Cal Township. And it's a very flat area, so it collects a lot of sediment. The water doesn't always move as well as we'd like it to. So we do have to maintain that a little more often than other ditches, so we generally get to that every about 10 years or so is what we've been trying to do, or a little sooner.
Mm-hmm. The idea, I guess, to have the ditches, of course, is to allow agricultural areas to be more useful. Otherwise, they'd probably be flooded all the time. And also, too, I guess you have a lot of wetland area. Maybe people don't realize that, or maybe it seems that most of the wetland that is around in Lake County is all south of, say, U.S. 30.
Yeah, that's where a lot of it historically was, and especially around the Kankakee River in the far south portion of the county, probably
the south quarter of the county used to be all a marsh, a wetland, which was drained in the early 1900s to create some really good farmland that we have now. But that land kind of always wants to return to that state. So it's kind of a constant battle, making sure that we maintain these waterways. And also, like I said, the Katy Marsh Ditch area and other areas in North Lake County were historically wetlands that were drained and then developed. So it's kind of a constant maintenance of these waterways that we have to do to make sure that people don't flood.
That's probably the most important thing that we note here. It's because of all of this development going from agricultural land to being developed in one way or the other, and it even comes down to, I guess, when you have big parking lots, you have additional problems that make it more difficult to get the ditches to drain properly.
That's a really good point. So with the unincorporated areas, which we control the development in, and almost, I think, well, every municipality has ordinances that are very similar that require new developments to detain that water that runs off the buildings and the impervious areas so that it releases at a slower rate and doesn't harm anybody downstream.
What would you say as far as the areas that either are flood prone the most or do actually flood the most are ones that you and your crews at the surveyor's office have to keep the closest eye on the ditches to make sure that they are flowing as they should?
We see a lot of issues down by the Kankakee River in our jurisdiction that just historically it's been a lot of issues down there. So we spend a lot of time in that area. We're also working right now with the state of Indiana and all the eight counties that border or that the Kankakee River goes through. We're working with those counties to come up with a plan for better maintenance and kind of management of the river. And the state's been great to work with on that, and we've been working on that through the KRBC. We also see a lot of issues on Hart Ditch in Dyer in Munster, and we're working with the Little Calumet River Basin and the towns of Highland and Munster and Dyer to address some of those issues right now as well.
Now, I know that your department has basically four people that work with you full-time on keeping these ditches well-maintained, and you probably have to hire some extra help in the summer months, too, to get more work done, don't you?
Yeah, we do. So all winter we see obstruction. So we've been trying to keep a kind of a skeleton crew on the drainage crew throughout the winter to address these issues. But the summer months when we see a lot of the rain and a lot of the trees fall in that we need to get taken out, we do have four-member crews that work throughout the summer independently and sometimes together, depending on if it's a really big job. But on the smaller jobs, we can sometimes split them up to make them even more efficient.
What do the crews typically do when they go in? I'm sure they have a list if they haven't checked it out themselves. You've kept them posted on what has to be done in a particular area. What do they have to do when they go in to do some maintenance work, to some cleanup work, I guess?
Yeah, so basically it all starts with me and my drainage administrator. We actually reached out to Jerome Prince this year. He has a really cool program through a company called NearMap that does aerial photography a little more frequently than we have in the past because it's getting more cost-effective to do that. And so we look at that kind of more current aerial photography. I think the last one we have is from late September to find these obstructions in remote areas that are really hard to get to sometimes to inspect physically. So we find these obstructions and then we drop the coordinates to our crew, and that they go out. First thing is to make sure that it's safe to do by hand, and we don't need to hire a contractor with a machine to do it. And if they can do it, then they go in actually by hand and waders, and a lot of times they fall in, but that's part of the job too.
It's probably an occupational hazard, you know, especially if you're in the water. Yeah,
yeah, which is not bad in the hot summer months. Sometimes they enjoy it. So. And so they go in with the chainsaws by hand and usually with ropes, rip out the obstruction and put it in a place where it won't wash back in. And then they also have a winch on one of the trucks that they can use if the obstruction's too big.
Now you talk about having contractors that help you out if it gets too big. What equipment do they bring in to be able to help clear things out if you need them?
Yeah, so we generally just an excavator, a regular excavator. We do have one contractor that we're in touch with who has actually a floating machine excavator that can get into areas that some can't. But that, again, that gets very expensive to do, just to mobilize that machinery and have contractors come out. So, and that's kind of the prices that we use to compare what we spent on our seasonal drainage crew versus what that would have cost. And we've come up with $433,000, $433,632 of savings as of October 25th.
I'm sure the Lake County Commissioners probably appreciate that work that they'll be able to do with their own people as opposed to having to hire additional crews.
Oh, they absolutely do. And I think the council is really happy about it, too, because we're always looking for ways to save money.
Well, and this, since the county council is one that keeps the purse string, so to speak, and they keep you and other department heads in the county government in line to make sure you toe the line on the budget, they probably are hoping that you'll find any cost-effective way to do so. Now that you've gotten one season of cleanup here lately out of the way, what can you plan for work in 2019?
Well, I think it's going to be more of the same. These obstructions are kind of constantly happening, especially, you know, with the wind that we have, for example, the last couple of days, there's going to be a lot of trees down and obstructions in our waterways. So it's a constant battle, really. And we constantly have beavers working, creating beaver dams that can really impact properties and property values. So we're constantly working on it.
Now, obviously, you're focusing in, of course, on the drainage ditches, mainly in South Lake County, but in the areas that are unincorporated outside of the cities and the towns. You mentioned Calumet Township in particular, and for one ditch there, the Katie Marsh ditch. What help do you get, or at least guidance from the cities and towns, from their governments, to let you know about problems that maybe they may be able to handle themselves, but they probably ask for a helping hand?
Oh, they do, and we have really good relationships, too, with the municipalities. And actually, one of the really great things they do is a lot of times if we're in a municipality, especially a more developed area, say in Highland there on the Katie Marsh ditch, we'll remove obstructions and they'll come and either chip it for us or haul away the debris. So it's a really good working relationship that we have.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that you get to work closely with not only the municipalities, but also you mentioned the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission. And in fact, we've had conversations with Dan Repay before about the work that they do. They have, of course, a big list that they try to take care of whenever the weather breaks in the spring to be able to do a cleanup along the levee system and the river that they're concerned about. What kind of help can they offer you, or do they offer you on a regular basis to help take care of these problems?
Yeah, we work really well with the Little Calumet River Basin Commission as well. Dan Repay, you know, him and I are texting, you know, during rain events, trying to coordinate either response efforts or things like that. We also have done some joint projects with them, and they've funded us on some of our projects. So it's really good relationship. And like I said, we're working with Dan and his board on the Hart Ditch north of Main Street, which is not currently a county-regulated drain, but it has some pretty significant bank erosion issues and things like that. So we're kind of in talks right now with them and the town of Munster and Highland to try to address some of those issues that have been around for a long time.
When you go even further to the east, in places like over in the area around Gary and points to the east in Hobart and the like, you probably have to do more work in some of those open areas. I imagine that would require some special attention.
Yeah, you know, absolutely, and it's all related. It's all connected. You know, water doesn't know the boundary between Hobart and Lake Station or anything else. So it's something that we all really have been working on together.
You mentioned about the cooperation that you have from the municipalities and from the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission. When it is time to have to deal with flooding problems or potential flooding problems, what can you do to be ahead of the game, so to speak, to be able to help keep the obstructions down more than you are? When it starts to rain, you're busy, like you say, you're texting with Dan Repay to find out what the situation may be in his particular neck of the woods, so to speak. But what can you do and get your crews on the surveyor's office do to help keep the drainage ditches even cleaner, even though you do the regular maintenance?
I think we're doing everything we can right now. I mean, we're trying to, again, keep the communication lines open. Quite honestly, I'm very lucky to have the council and commissioners that I have to have the budget that we have. We have a $2.1 million budget next year to do a lot of these improvements that really, really need to be done. And I think I think the citizens want that to be done. They want these infrastructure improvements, and I think all the elected officials, at least in Lake County, are on board with that.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.